You're listening to the Mythgreen Podcast with your hosts, Oren Ashkenazi, Wes Matlock, and Chris Winkle. There was a castle by a waterfall with a pink and purple wall and a princess living there. She had no parents and was all alone. She got by on her own and she liked it pretty well. Cause she never wore socks, she had a pet snake, she bought a red guitar and she ate a whole cake. And there wasn't anybody there to tell her what to do, so she did what she wanted to. Everybody knew the story of the princess who saved herself.
This episode is brought to you by our patrons, Kathy Ferguson, professor of political theory in Star Trek, and Ari Ashkenazi.
Welcome to the Mythgreen Podcast. I'm Chris, and with me is...
Oren.
And...
Wes.
And we are doing part two of favorite and least favorite core dice mechanics. I want to start off with a question for you guys. So there are some like mechanics that are just hard to learn because people, not because they're inherently bad if they were existed in a vacuum, but because people are used to something different.
Yeah.
So one question is for you, but like, even so, if you're a GM and you sit down with your players, you can still expect a higher learning curve for your players. So how much would you judge a system for doing something different, even if it technically by itself would be just as valid? Is that something we should be harsh about, or is that something that we should cut a little slack for?
I would judge it poorly. It is legit hard to tell the difference between a mechanic that is like actually confusing and a mechanic that is fine in a vacuum but is different than what you're used to. Like, that is a legit question that is hard to know. And I would argue that for the most part, it does not matter, because role-playing games are, frankly, not that big a design space. If you're serious about role-playing, you can play most of the important systems. Like, you know, there's not that much out there. There's a lot of, like, little ones, but the big ones are all pretty easily accessible, and you don't need to take a million years to learn them. So if you are going to deviate from what's been established, you need a reason. Like, you need to be actually creating some kind of new functionality that you could not get with a system that already existed. Well, like, with a core die mechanic specifically. Because, like, you don't want to copy an entire system, because that could be an issue. But, like, you know, but, like, the core dice mechanics are not copyrighted. You can use them, you can use whatever you like, and there are plenty out there and that people already know. So if you're gonna change them and make a new one, it had better actually do something useful. Otherwise, there's no point.
No, I completely agree, especially if I've spent all my time learning the crazy ins and outs of how this like one thing like works and I barely understand it, and all of a sudden something different comes along and I hate it just because it's different and I've already put so much of myself into trying to figure out what's going on with the other ones.
Like, just as an example, Star Wars Edge of the Empire, or whatever Fantasy Flight is calling it, the Fantasy Flight Star Wars system, I don't actually like that system very much, but I will concede that it does something that you could not do with one of the existing like big systems. Because what it does is, when you roll your dice, they have both success and failure options and advantage disadvantage options. And what the advantage and disadvantage options do is they dictate how cool your success is.
Or how cool your failure, can you have a cool failure?
Or how bad your failure is, or how much complication your success has, or how much, like, cool factor your failure has, right?
Okay.
And I don't like that, because as a GM, I don't like being dictated to by the dice on how to describe things.
You must describe this as totally awesome.
Right, like, I find it better to allow the circumstance, to allow the description to flow from the circumstances. But, like, I know some people really enjoy that, and that is not something that other die mechanics do. This is a die mechanic that, built right into it, forces the GM to describe things a certain way. And if your GM's just bad at description normally, or needs prompting, or you just, like, feel like they are not giving you your due, you can point to the dice and say, no, man, you gotta describe my cool shoulder roll. I have an advantage. You can't just say that I succeeded and move on. And I don't like it for a lot of reasons. A big reason I don't like it is that their dice packs cost $15 each. But that is a reason to create a new die mechanic, right? because there was no other die mechanic out there that did what they needed it to do. Compare that to something like Mistborn, the Mistborn adventure game. Because I guess role-playing...
AKA, what the hell is going on?
Right. Because I guess role-playing games are for nerds, so this is an adventure game. Different than role-playing games.
Uh-huh. Oh, yeah. Totally.
And it has, like, a weird matching system where higher is better, except sixes. Like, sixes are actually bad because they don't actually help you succeed at a task. They just, like, describe how cool your success is, which isn't helpful if you don't succeed. So it is really bizarre, and it's just, like, not... It doesn't provide anything useful. It's just, like, a brand new mechanic that takes you a long time to learn.
Yeah. The whole matching numbers, again, when we talk about time from, like, roll to figuring out success or failure, like, it's just an unintuitive enough that once you roll, it's like, okay... Now I've got to look for matching numbers. Yeah. Now it's like, isn't it like, what is the highest matching number?
Yes.
It's not just how many pairs of matching you have. It's like, okay, now here's the highest matching number. and then it's like, but we want a five, but no, not a six. Not always. We don't always want a six or need more sixes. Mm-hmm. And then it's also because it's unusual, obscures, again, as I said in the last episode, I like to know what my chances of success are before I roll. It just helps me manage if I have meta currency to spend or risk to manage. You know, if I'm wondering whether or not to try something as a character, and I'm asking the GM how difficult would this be, you know, and the GM responds in like, you know, terminology as to like what my chances of how difficult would be to roll against it with the dice. It's good to know like what my actual chances of success or failure are. And thinking about like highest matching numbers really, really throws a wrench in the works when you're trying to intellectualize this and figure it out.
Yeah. It's like,
yeah,
we're primed to like roll and count, not like roll and like pair up.
And it's like also weird because like getting a matching number is not hard on like multiple dice, but the system like has you rolling like many dice, like, okay, and like the difference between like a regular character and a character who is super power game to roll lots of dice is absurd. Like a character who is good at something, like normally good at something, can roll like between 6 and 8 d6, which is a fair bit, and you're pretty guaranteed to get a decent matching pair at that point. A character that is like magic and super magic can roll in excess of 50 dice.
What?
If they're using if they're using the right kind of magic system. Now, but the game caps the number of dice you can roll at 10. Which is like, okay, so if you can roll so many so easily, why is it capped at 10? That's weird. But then it gets weirder. Every die that you get over a 6, over 10, just becomes an automatic 6. But those only matter if, like, for determining if you succeed or fail or not, if you get a tie. So what you end up with a lot is a character who's rolling, like, 50 dice who... like, a lot of the time isn't any better than a normal character, but when they roll, like, 2 fives, it's impossible to beat them, and they can, like, lift houses suddenly. It's it is a weird dice mechanic, and it's super different for no reason.
This is like the non-Euclidean, like, dice system. Like, if you try to figure it out, you will go insane.
you have lost sanity trying.
Another system that is... again, unnecessarily complicated for no reason that I can figure out, is so Full Light, Full Steam.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, it's like a steampunk game that you can play. And it has this weird system where you roll, like, is it, I think, 4 dice. So always roll 4 dice. But then after you roll them, you have to order them from the highest to lowest. And then you have, like, a skill that's 1 through 4.
Oh, my God.
And then if you have a... so then if you have a skill of 3, it's, like, the second to highest dice. Like, out of... whereas, like, 4 is the highest one.
So, oh my god, I can barely.
It almost seems like I'm joking, right?
Yeah, it
almost seems
like
I must have made this up. No, this is actually
like a belated April Fool's joke. You are both pulling on me.
No, this is real. The system is real. And I played it specifically because a commenter like told me to play it because I was like too steeped in the soulless minions of orthodoxy, and like I needed to like you know play some new like. You know, revolutionary systems, and this game definitely thinks it's revolutionary reading its flavor text. And so I played it, and I was like, this game is absolutely awful. My favorite, so Chris just described the core die mechanic. So you actually pick two dice, one for your skill, one for your stat.
But they can't be the same, right? So if collisions.
That's what it said. The game does not describe anywhere I could find in the rule book what to do if your skill and your stat are the same level. Like, if they're both four, do you just take the highest one twice? Or do you take the highest one and then it's gone, so the next highest one would slide up? It doesn't say. It does not say anywhere in there. And that is a really important distinction. because with the rules as written, if you play it that with the idea that you take the top one twice, if you have a skill and a stat at four, 12 is listed as impossible. So suddenly you can just get the high, and like on 46 you have, I think I calculated it, a 56% chance that one of them will be a six.
Okay, so I have an important message to game designers.
Yeah.
Never give a number for things that are impossible.
Yeah, just don't do it.
If it's impossible, it should not have a difficulty number assigned to it, because it's supposed to be impossible. Which means no matter how high the number you get, it should still be impossible, yeah. Right? Like,
right. And like, even if you ignore the fact that it says impossible, that's still the highest you can roll, and once you get to a 4 stat, 4 skill, which is not that hard to do, you can easily do it right out of character creation. You, 50% of the time, 56% of the time, you will just roll maximum.
Right, and there's no way to, like, make anything harder, right?
Yeah.
Because it's 56% to absolutely impossible. There's no matter what you roll for this dice, you cannot get it. So
yeah.
There's no way to, like, make it harder for them to roll without making it, like, completely unachievable.
Right, because there's no way to roll a 13. So I can't make anything difficulty 13. it is a bizarre little game. I do not recommend. Wes, why don't you tell us about one of your least favorite systems? Because Chris and I have ranted quite a bit.
Yeah, so I mentioned on the last podcast that I dabbled in Call of Cthulhu at the request of a friend. And, like, it just... I can't even remember. It was something like I had to have like my core abilities, or Neil probably help me understand this, but I had
yes.
like my main abilities. Then I had to do quite a bit of math, and then I had
yeah.
like 250 some like things to like distribute, which then
yep.
meant that I had all these skills, which like weren't like things that I added. They were like percentages. And then every roll was like a weird, like, dice system that was like golf. It was like I had to like fight myself to do anything.
Mm-hmm.
Like, okay. I think I barely got through that, and then was like promised that I would never subject myself to that again.
It's because in Call of Cthulhu, for a long time in Call of Cthulhu, your stats didn't really do anything.
Mm-hmm.
Like, you had your base stats, and each of them had, like, one very small thing that they did. Like, strength added to your melee damage for all the punching you were doing in Call of Cthulhu.
So much.
Although, ironically, in the older editions of the game, you could make a kung fu character who could kick harder than a gun, which was amazing. But most characters aren't going to be doing a lot of that in Call of Cthulhu. Constitution or like size, constitution and size were different. They like determined like your hit points, but like again it was the difference between like 10 and 12 hit points. It like barely mattered, because if you ever got hit by anything in Call of Cthulhu you were probably dead anyway.
Uh-huh.
And then there was the stats that actually mattered were power, which determined your sanity level, and then intelligence and education that determined how many skill points you had. So skills were what you actually rolled.
Right.
And then there was, like, appearance, which literally did nothing. It literally had no game mechanics. It was just appearance. It was just a number that told you how hot you were.
Try to console yourself with, like, your lack of skills in education. And he's like, right. Well, I got a really high appearance score.
And in 7th edition...
I fail everything, but I'm really sexy while I'm doing it.
Yeah. In 7th edition, they changed it, and the stats are more relevant somehow, but I forget exactly how.
Yeah, I definitely played the 6th edition that time. So.
Right. So then you have your skills, and you have to roll equal to or under your skill.
Under?
Which means that, yeah, equal to or under on a percentile. Your skills are rated from 1 to 100.
Yeah, I mean, I will give it this. In When Call of Cthulhu, like, remember I talked about, like, wanting to know about my chance of success? At least in Call of Cthulhu, it's very unintuitive, but at least your skill is your chance of success.
Mm, yeah,
that's a good point, yeah.
You always know your chance of success because that's what your skill number means.
It does have that. I actually don't think that's a good thing. But some, you know, if you really want to know your chances of success, Call of Cthulhu is your system. But what it has the side effect of, and this is all systems based off using what's called the basic role-playing system. Call of Cthulhu is only one of them. All of them have this problem that everything you attempt, the difficulty is based on your skill, not what you're attempting. Mm. So it's like, you know, trying to land a plane is a test. Trying to fly a plane at Mach 3 down the Grand Canyon is a test. Those are the same difficulty. And that's why, like, Call of Cthulhu games go so gonzo so quickly a lot of the time, because, like, the success-failure rates bear no resemblance to what's actually being described at the table, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And this is the part where every Call of Cthulhu defender tells me, but the GM can give you a bonus or penalty based on how difficult the situation is. It's like, yeah, but they never remember to do that.
No.
Yeah.
It's no. Super...
I will also say, as a player, if you have a default difficulty and the GM has to adjust it, that whenever the GM decides to make it harder, I feel outrage. You know, it's like, yo, GM, how dare you ping me?
Yeah, you never trust what they say anymore behind their screens.
Where it's like, when it's a system where there is no default difficulty and the GM has to set one, I never feel cheated when they make it hard, unless it seems abnormally hard, but... If my character's not OP and the GM's not compensating for the fact that my character's OP, then I don't feel cheated when they make it hard. It just feels like it's a hard task. But when it's when you have a default difficulty and the GM has to modify it, now suddenly, like, it feels like the GM is, like, injuring you or being unfair or something when they actually have to make something harder, which is not a position I don't think that you should have, you know?
Yeah, and the BRP system has... It is really hard to make an opposed role in BRP. Like, for a long time in Call of Cthulhu, the way that you made opposed roles was you, like, you checked what your two stats were, and then you, like, consulted a table to tell you who had what percentage chance of succeeding. And it was like, what the heck? And then, like, if you wanted to make a direct one with skills, like, your options are basically to like, see who rolls lowest under their skill, but then you have to do math to, like, see, like, to subtract your roll from your skill to see who succeeded by more. Or you can do what's it called? Not Mistborn. There's a fantasy system that I'm forgetting. I'll put it in the show notes. That does this, where it's, instead, it's whoever succeeds, by the least. So, like, you know, it's like if you succeed and the other player succeeds and your role is higher than theirs, then you win. And you don't have to do math like that, but it's super unintuitive.
Huh.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, no, the BRP system is absolute garbage.
Yeah.
And, like, you can tell it's absolute garbage because in Delta Green, which is the newest system I know of that uses it, there are, like, a lot of ways they came up with to avoid having to roll. because I think they know it's garbage. They'll fight me about it on the internet if I ever find them. But like, I think on some level they know it's bad and they're stuck with it because that's what they've always used. But they're, like, trying to figure out ways around the problem.
Hmm. Yeah, yeah. And again, rolling so that you're trying to get low instead of high is one of those things where, like, objectively, if in a vacuum, it's not any worse than rolling trying to get high, but all of the other systems are rolled, most of the other systems, I should say, are rolled to get high, so it's just really, like, does a number on you if you're learning to try and learn to roll low instead of high.
Remember back in the day with to hit armor class zero and everything that was involved in that? Like,
no.
I know. I think I tried, and I think I, like, lost, like, all of my memories from, like, sixth grade.
I have literally never played THACO, like, in pencil and paper form. The only time I've ever interacted with THACO was through Baldur's Gate.
Yeah, and a computer could do it for you, so.
Yeah, I was gonna say, I have actually played the older editions of D&D, the ones that are like, you know, the basic D&D or advanced D&D that are actually pretty simple in comparison. I have never played I think it was it second ed, the one that had THACO? I have never played that one.
Yeah, I remember I got that, and It was the starter kit with the prefab characters, and the art was great and everything was fun. And then I, like, tried to figure out what was going on, and yeah, like, as I said, things went poorly.
And, like, this is why I don't get it when I see people on the internet saying that 5th edition D&D is like a balance between 3rd edition and 2nd edition, and I'm like, how?
No.
How is it like 2nd edition? At all. Like, nothing. And when I ask people, they're like, oh, well, it has fewer bonuses. And I'm like, that doesn't make it more like second edition. That makes it more like most games that exist. You know, like the things that make second edition unique are not in fifth edition. Thank God. Because they're awful. You know? So, like, this is why it gets weird when you're trying to argue with people about D&D, and D&D is the only system they know about. It gets very complicated.
So, I think that since we've already covered Call of Cthulhu, I think we are now ready to talk about GURPS.
GURPS. No. You know, Chris, I've never actually played GURPS, so explain. Yeah, tell me.
Tell us what this is.
I have not played GURPS extensively, but, like, it has a dice mechanic that is not good, and to me it has, like, all of the bad things about Call of Cthulhu plus additional bad things.
Oh, really? There are extra bad things. How does that work?
Okay, so like Call of Cthulhu, in GURPS, the skill is a difficulty level, and instead of, like, having a set difficulty, you are trying to roll against your skill level. And low is good, because you need to roll under it, and the idea is that as your skill goes up, it gets easier, just like Call of Cthulhu. But instead of having a, like, two D10s where you get, like, a number of 1 out of 100 and you can easily sort of see what your chances are and easily come up with what your die results are, it's actually a tallied dice pool system. So you have to roll a number of dice and then add them together.
Oh, that sounds, good. That sounds intuitive.
So basically if the average stat is, like, you have is skill level is like 10, or it might be skill plus attributes, but a little while, and then you have, you know, like 3d6 or something, and you just always so it's a static dice pool on top of it, and then, like, on average you'll get like 10 and a half of them added up together with your, and then, yeah, it's really, really counterintuitive. And it doesn't have, again, at least Call of Cthulhu, it's at least when you're rolling, it's pretty transparent. But with GURPS, not only do you have to roll low, but then you have to add a bunch of numbers together.
Weird.
So, Wes, do you want to tell us about one of your favorites? Because, like, I know Chris and I have both mentioned the ours.
Oh.
The one that you like?
Yeah.
I mean, and this Trail of Cthulhu, right?
I mean, I don't know, like, as I said at the start of the previous episode we did on this, like, I am kind of limited to my primary experiences with D&D, and then Trail, and so I guess it's hard to say, like, which one I prefer. I kind of, like, section them off differently, and I guess, like, I enjoy 5th edition. I enjoy it a lot more than 3.5. I skipped 4, just for,
that's fair.
Just, yeah, I think I read enough to justify that. But I guess, like, the people I play with, we've kind of been playing together for so long that we've just, I mean, it's rules as we've interpreted them for quite a while at this point now. So it's kind of hard to, like, justify, like, how much I like our gameplay based on the actual system and what we've gone ahead and customized and house ruled and stuff like that. I mean, I would enjoy playing one of the success pool type systems like you guys have talked about. That appeals to me because I'm generally in favor of anything that like lets you right away and move on. I don't want to spend time like having to consult a table. I don't want to spend time looking stuff up in a book. I don't want to spend time doing math. Like I want to roll and know and do stuff. Like that's the fun part.
Yeah.
But I mean, yeah. And I like the risk element. I like the hilarity of rolling like a one in the D20 systems and like trying to figure out what's going on with that. But yeah, like it's all a successful system for me is predicated on there being fewer rolls that are like more meaningful. And if you can just like average like the number for something with like your modifiers and like that lets somebody be a success, like whoever's running the show should know that and try to like reduce it. Cause you know, people roll dice or they roll dice off the table and they have to go find them. And you know, like there's just, you don't want to slow down play for something silly like math or lost dice.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So one system that is not a system I would like to play all the time, but it does scratch a very specific itch, is Tenra Bancho Zero, which is an actual Japanese role-playing game. Mm-hmm. It's the only one I've ever played. And it is it's like based off of like, you know, it's like a Japanese anime RPG, but like actually written by people from Japan instead of Westerners trying to imitate Japanese anime.
Oh, okay.
So it's definitely a bit of a trip if you're a Western player and you're like trying to understand all of the like Japanese culture that goes into this game. But one thing that it does is it has you roll buckets of dice. And normally I don't like doing that, you know, like that's annoying. It's like, okay, there's too many dice. I want to roll and move on. But sometimes I like to pick up like a whole handful of dice and be like, this is my ultimate final stage God Killer Buster Break, and like roll for it, right? And it's like, okay, that I just did that now. That's a thing I did. And so, you know, that would get boring really quickly, but for like a one shot, yeah, it's great. And that's what it's made for anyway, is one shots.
That reminds me of Anima Prime with this like mm-hmm. dice pools that you like move, like you upgrade dice from a lower level pool to a higher level pool before using it. It's like gathering power.
Yeah, exactly.
I charge up and then I unleash.
It's like you gotta charge your laser for a while, you know, everybody knows that.
For a while, I think it got lost eventually, but we used to have this like jumbo size D20 that like we would roll for like special occasions. And of course it's hilarious because like there's no guarantee that just because it's a big dice means there's gonna be like awesome results. Like, so.
I don't know, man, bigger is better. So
you're right though, Oren. Like there's something satisfying about just like this like thunderous like roll on the table of like giant dice or tons of them and stuff.
And like I'll admit I have a soft spot for dice pool systems that use other dice. Like I'm still on the hunt for a D12 dice pool system. I found one, but it was bad. Unfortunately that's out the window. And I get why more people don't make them, is because like, you know, it's hard enough to sell a role-playing game without telling people they have to go buy a bunch of D12s.
Yeah, I have to say that the thing that I find attractive that is totally impractical as far as dice go is the, and I don't know how many systems, if any, actually do this, where, maybe Firefly does, where you actually change what dice you use once you level up.
Oh, actually,
so
yeah,
you go from, like, yeah, starting with a D4 to a D6 to a D8, and you get all the way up to, like, a D20 or something, putting on, because you can use all of them.
I was just thinking, I looked over at my bookshelf, and I saw the Serenity book right there. I think we played it, like, once, but yeah, all your stats are even, like, rolls, too, right? Isn't that how that whole game mm-hmm. works?
Yeah, all of your, it's like your stats are rated by die type.
Right.
Yeah, but then not only does everybody have to have, like, all of the dice, but then you know that at the table there's going to be lots of, like, is that a D10 or a D12? Or, like, a D14? Yeah. Like, you know?
And then you need to color code them, right? And get, like, special sets.
All right, well, we have run out of time for a second time, but at least I feel like we got through more of our notes today. So thank you both for joining me again. And for those of you at home, if anything we said piqued your interest, you can email us at podcast@mythgreens.com. Otherwise, we will talk to you next week. There was a dragon with a pointy tail. He was bigger than a whale, and his breath was terrible. He scared the princess when he came around. Tried to burn the castle down, but she caught him by his tail. Then she tied him to a tree so the dragon couldn't fly. She told him he was mean, and it made the dragon cry. When he finally apologized, she offered him some tea. He accepted it graciously. Now he visits every weekend with the princess.
This has been the Mythgreant Podcast. Opening closing theme, The Princess Who Saved Herself, by Jonathan Colton.